WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. New York Times writer Howard French spent more than a decade roaming some of the farthest reaches of Africa, tracking down the continent's leaders, its tyrants, and its forgotten people. The countries he visited, Mali, Congo, Nigeria, Liberia, Angola, have all suffered, he says, at the hands of the West. Tonight on Point, Hope and Tragedy in Africa. But first, as many as 3,000 people may have been killed in North Korea less than 24 hours ago when two trains collided, one carrying gasoline and a second carrying liquefied petroleum gas. The explosion occurred just 9 hours after North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-il, had passed through after a three-day trip to Beijing. North Korea declared a state of alert in the area and cut some international telephone lines. Gordon Fairclough, Wall Street Journal's Korea correspondent, joins me now on the line. Hello, Gordon.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. I know it's difficult getting information because those phone lines have been cut, but what do you know so far?
Well, we actually know very little. Even when the phone lines are working, of course, reporting on North Korea is a considerable challenge, and I think that the quality of the information that's out there, I think is quite suspect at this point. Even the casualty figures that I've seen are attributed to unnamed sources 15 miles away on the other side of the international border. So I think it's very difficult right now to tell what's really happening there.
Well, Kim Jong-il had passed through the area, we're told, a few hours before the explosion on his way back from a rare trip to China. Has anyone seen him since?
Our understanding is that he had passed through there about 9 hours ahead of the time that the accident took place. I don't know that he's been seen since. State media in North Korea has been silent so far, now almost, closing in on 20 hours perhaps after the accident. Still no word of what happened in the official media.
But I take it that's not surprising. As you say, it's a very secretive society, so presumably they wouldn't be very eager to share bad news, this kind of bad news, with the rest of the world.
That's true. It is a society that that doesn't like bad news. In speaking last night with South Korean intelligence and national security officials, they said that there was no indication they had that it was anything but an accident at this point.
Do we have any idea as to whether North Korea's hospitals are equipped to handle something that could be this catastrophic?
They're almost certainly not, or are certainly not. The North Korean healthcare system is in shambles. Some of the reports on the wires indicate that some people who were injured were taken across the border into China. That's an area on the border there where there's a lot of traders who cross back and forth, ethnic Koreans who are Chinese nationals, and ethnic Chinese nationals who cross back and forth. So I would imagine anyone with Chinese citizenship would aim to be evacuated rather than treated in North Korea.
And do you have any sense of whether North Korea, if this does turn out to be monumental in its scope, whether the North Koreans would accept help from the outside?
Well, they have in the past. It's actually been foreign aid that's kind of been keeping them afloat for years now. After extremely bad famine in the mid to late 90s, the international community has stepped up with food aid. The North Koreans did accept it, so I suspect that they would. Once they get a handle on what's going on, probably given the geography, they would look to China for help on something like this.
Well, Gordon, thank you so much, and you probably need to get back to work.
My pleasure. Take care.
Gordon Fairclough is the Wall Street Journal's Korea correspondent. He spoke with me from Hong Kong. In his new book, A Continent for the Taking, The Tragedy and Hope of Africa, New York Times reporter Howard French says Africa is the stage of mankind's greatest tragedies. The West plundered the continent for rubber, cotton, gold, and diamonds. Today it happily extracts Africa's oil, yet downplays its crises to avoid direct involvement. Tonight on Point, inside a troubled Africa. Why has stability and prosperity eluded Africa? Who's to blame for its problems? For former President Charles Taylor in Liberia, Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. What responsibility does the West, does the United States have for helping Africa rise above its conflicts? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now is Howard French. He is a senior writer at the New York Times, and since 1986, he has reported for the Times from Central America, the Caribbean, West and Central Africa, Japan, Korea, and now China. And his new book is A Continent for the Taking, The Tragedy and Hope of Africa. Welcome, Howard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we appreciate your taking the time to talk with us and also tell us some of your remarkable stories that you tell in the book. I wonder if you'd start with what I'm thinking of as Welcome to Nigeria. That's a story that taught you an important lesson about the way you would have to be to survive there.
Indeed. My very first trip on my assignment for the New York Times in 1994 was a trip from Abidjan, which was the economic capital of Ivory Coast, where my bureau was located, to Lagos, which is the economic capital of Nigeria, a few hundred miles to the east. And it was very difficult back then to get a visa to Nigeria. It still is Africa's most populous country and one of its very most important. And so getting there is always going to be a priority for a West African correspondent, for any newspaper. I managed to secure a visa and was very excited about the prospect in my very first days in the assignment of getting to Nigeria. And I landed at the Lagos airport and had arranged to have a driver meet me, the driver who had worked with my predecessor, because the Lagos airport was notorious for banditry of all sorts, from banditry committed by the soldiers and immigration people who work at the airport to highwaymen, literally, on the roads leading into town. And a plainclothes policeman or someone claiming to be such some soldiers waylaid us on our way out of the airport with me and my driver carrying our bags to his car. And a very tense scene ensued with them trying to get us to surrender our papers with the ultimate goal of getting a lot of money out of us. And my driver, being a very brave man, refused. And a very tense showdown ensued with him. As they raised their rifles, presumably to fire, speeding off, and me ducking in the back of the seat, not knowing whether I was going to be drilled full of bullets or not.
You must have been pretty astonished by that greeting, I would think.
Welcome to Nigeria and welcome to Africa.
And his advice to you was what?
It was, you cannot afford to be afraid. You can never back down. You have to keep going, and you have to do what you know you need to do and not give an inch. My driver's name was David. He was an extraordinarily gritty man, and his advice served me very well over the coming 4 years.
I was going to say it was not an isolated story, because it seems as if throughout the book you had such problems everywhere you went, getting out, coming in, moving from place to place. It seems as if every other moment you were having to turn around and explain yourself, defend yourself, figure out how you were going to get out of one hot spot after the other.
Indeed. I haven't sat down to count them, but I was arrested quite a few times. The two biggest problem countries were Zaire, which has since renamed itself Congo, and Nigeria. There were some other hot spots like Liberia and Sierra Leone, where troubles were fairly frequent. But a very big part of my job was simply surviving and getting in and out, as you said, and managing to sort of keep one's possessions about oneself and not be arrested or detained.
What are your own ties to Africa? What was it that drew you there and that kept you there for so long?
My father is a physician, and when I was entering college, he was actually a surgeon by training and had a midlife change in which he decided to go to graduate school to Johns Hopkins and get a degree in international medicine. And he began to he used this in order to begin doing work for the World Health Organization in Africa. And just as I was going off to college in the States, my father moved with my younger brothers and sisters to Ivory Coast and to lead a World Health Organization program for primary health care program for 20 African countries. And so I felt very much, I was full of envy that my siblings had had this extraordinary adventure and wonderful experience, and here I was in Western Massachusetts in college. And so I resolved that when I graduated, I would spend a year in college, and I thought that maybe I would become a lawyer and applied to law schools. I took the LSAT and did okay. And so I told my parents, as they were sort of late in their stay in Africa, I was going to go and spend a year, and I had some work lined up as a French and English translator and later as a professor at the University of Ivory Coast. I'd spend a year and then come back and proceed with the rest of my life. Well, Africa grabbed me by the throat, if you will, back then, not in a menacing way, but just really sort of seized me and fascinated me, and the sense of adventure and possibilities in life that I had never really imagined existed before became apparent. And a one-year stay became a six-year stay. I became a freelance journalist for the Washington Post, and I began writing for many other publications. And I taught for 2 years, but ended up quitting teaching to become a journalist full-time, and I never looked back. I never did go to law school. Hmm. So that was the rest of the story.
You describe Africa as something of a great treasure chest that was plundered by almost the entire world over years and years of time. And I wonder if that was the vision you held going in, or is that what emerged from your experiences during all the time that you spent there?
I didn't have a deeply informed vision going in. When my parents began planning to move to Africa, I began reading whatever I could read about the continent, but I didn't go into this with any deeply formed point of view or angle on the story of Africa. But the more I learned, the more I was fascinated, and the more I traveled, the more I wanted to see and to learn. And indeed, I describe the continent as a treasure chest, historically speaking, but I should say that Africa remains a treasure chest, that this plunder, which you so succinctly described in your intro, is proceeding apace. We have a president right now who, during the campaign, said that Africa was not part of the United States' vital interests. Well, I haven't checked this figure in the last 2 or 3 years, but certainly as recently as about 4 years ago, it was true that any one of the four cardinal regions of Africa, whether it's West, East, North, or South Africa, had collectively more trade with the United States than the entire former Soviet Union. We have a tremendous amount of commerce, mostly in natural resources, with oil being the number one item these days going on between the United States and Africa, and very little sense of political connection and certainly of responsibility toward the continent.
And that's not a new position either by the Bush administration, because, as you point out, Madeleine Albright said much the same thing in the 90s.
Indeed. We have a policy of Africa on the cheap. Africa is a very good deal for the United States and has been for as long as we've been dealing with it, whether it means getting slaves on the free to getting all sorts of natural resources, from huge and growing amounts of oil to things, exotic minerals like coltan or the uranium that fueled our atomic weapons program in the 1950s and 60s. We get these things from Africa without committing ourselves to any kind of serious and ongoing relationship with Africa. And the trend since the Somalia crisis during the Clinton administration has been to deliberately seek to avoid any kind of responsibility in Africa, to deliberately seek to avoid having to hold to come to the rescue, I guess is the best way to put it, when things get really ugly somewhere in the continent and large numbers of lives are being lost.
And just briefly before we have to take a break, what did that mean in that notion of Africa is not important? What did that mean when it came time for you to pitch stories to your editors?
Well, oddly, for someone who's just written a book about Africa, I didn't want to go back to Africa. I had been a freelancer, as I've explained to you, right after college. I had gotten into journalism and had written for the Washington Post and others. And when the Times hired me in 1986, there was an implicit promise that I would be sent overseas eventually. And for a long time, I said I didn't want to go to Africa, but they insisted ultimately. The end result of this was a bargain that we struck, that my stories would be treated well and that they would get someone that they thought of as really knowing the continent.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We're talking this hour about the hope and tragedy of Africa. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about Africa, its problems and its potential. Do we pay enough attention to Africa? What can and should America do to help Africa overcome its problems? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with Howard French. He is a senior writer at the New York Times, and his new book is A Continent for the Taking, The Tragedy and Hope of Africa. Howard, you say that your search for the authentic Africa wasn't so easy to find. Where did you begin to look, and are you ultimately satisfied that you did find it?
I am ultimately satisfied that I did find it. I also began over time as I searched to revise my notions of what the real Africa was, the authentic Africa was. I've been to pretty much every continent, every country in the continent now, and to most regions of most of these countries, and to the cities and to the rural areas and to the distant sort of darkest corners, to reprise a cliche. This initial search took place in my early period staying there in this first year after college, in which I went on a road trip with my brother, younger brother, Jamie, from Abidjan into all the way north through Ivory Coast in bush taxis, as they were called, and then through Mali all the way up to a town called Djene and to Mopti. We went to the Dogon area of Mali in the center of the country, just beneath the Sahara Desert. And we sort of watched with great fascination, this being one of my very earliest adventures in Africa, the taint or the influence, if you will, of Western culture, primarily since these were both former French colonies, of French commercialism and French influence, fall away as we went further and further inland. And Western hairstyles and Western dress and other Western modes began to sort of disappear gradually as we got deeper and deeper and deeper into the inland. And that's what I had in mind as when I thought about really looking, not being satisfied to be a few hundred miles away from the biggest city, but really looking for something authentic. And then the notion was something that has been relatively unaffected by the outside world.
Well, and speaking of which, you mentioned traveling through the Dogon area a moment ago. The cliff dwellers there raised some important what-if questions for you. What were those?
Indeed. This experience on that trip, visiting with the cliff dwellers, where my brother and I were received with great hospitality by teenage boys who lived in a village just off of the town Bandiagara in Dogon territory, made me think deeply about Africa in ways that I hadn't before and posed a question that stays with me to this day. The Dogon live, to a great extent, in the most difficult physical setting imaginable. They have moved far away from the banks of the Niger River, which is the lifeline in this desertified country, and have built dwellings in the sides of arid cliffs, where every aspect of life must be difficult, from access to water to sanitation to agriculture, you name it. And the reason they did this is because although their original homeland had been on the banks of the Niger River was a zone of ceaseless plunder, with Moroccan people coming from the north, Islamicizing that region of Africa, and stronger, larger, more centrally organized ethnic groups coming from the south, namely the Bambara, coming from the area of present-day Bamako, the capital of Mali, and trying to enslave people or put them under their cultural influence and economic influence. And the Dogon have a very interesting cosmology and many other aspects of life which are unique to them. And they decided this was vitally important, and the only way to preserve it was to go into an area that was inhospitable, that nobody would bother to conquer. And they did that hundreds of years ago, and they've been there ever since. And the result of this is that they have retained their lifestyle. They have retained this extraordinary cosmology. No one has managed to explain how they were able to do this, but they identified the star Sirius and its twin, which is invisible to the naked eye and was only discovered by Western scientists, astronomers, early in the 1900s. They identified the twin star of Sirius which is in a sort of a dual rotation. These two stars rotate around each other, and they described it, the metals that it is supposedly composed of, and these correspond eerily to the way Western scientists describe some of the physical aspects of this star. I've just mentioned this because this is an extraordinary people. This is just one element of their extraordinary culture, and they felt that it was enough. Preserving their identity was worth even living in the most difficult physical setting. The interest of the Dogon experience to me, the broader interest, is that Africa was derailed in the 1900s. You had proto-states. You had some very strong cultures and civilizations, some of which had developed postal services, diplomatic services, regularized taxation laws, police, all of the things that you think of, almost all of the things we think of as the functions of a state. And the continent was in the process, many areas of the continent were in the process of state formation, modern state formation. And the what-if question that fascinates me, obsesses me even, is if Europe had not come and conquered the continent at that point, might not we have today viable states with their own political cultures that have a sovereign sense of ownership of their nation, of their land, their own identities, and instead of the generalized strife and ethnic tension that we see in Africa today? And the Dogon managed to preserve their identity by virtue of isolation. And the what if is whether some of these other strong cultures, I will single out a few, the Ashanti culture in present-day Ghana, or the Dahomey people in present-day Benin, had they been afforded enough isolation back then, or had the Europeans simply been preoccupied elsewhere, perhaps we would have a very different Africa today.
Howard, I want to bring one of our listeners into the conversation from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Owen is on the line. Hello, Owen, and welcome.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that there are some, you know, I guess we've seen a very bleak picture of Africa, but there are some bright spots, some beacons of hope. I had a similar experience to your guest working in Africa right out of college, and you just, to see this country that was under, you know, arguably one of the most brutal regimes that the world has ever seen, Amin and Obote, and then to blossom into a real participatory democracy. You know, they're educating children, and you know, all from a generation of people who spent, you know, 20 years in the bush as rebels, and then came out and became university professors, doctors.
This was where again, Owen?
Uganda. But it's in a very fragile state. You know, Rwanda and Congo on their borders are falling apart, and it's it would take so little to do so much, and just to keep that that little spark alive. You know, people do so much with so little there, but it's I'm not sure if it can be sustained without without some support from the West.
All right, Owen, thank you so much for the call, and Howard, I'm sure you are nodding in agreement.
Yes and no. I mean, Uganda is a very interesting case, and it is touted often as a great success for Africa. I would single out other countries. I know there are many. Certainly, Uganda's economic growth rate of the last decade or so has been quite impressive by African standards and by global standards. I'm less impressed by Uganda's political culture. I don't think as much of the Ugandan notion, or at least the Ugandan president and his government's notion of democracy. And I think that the Ugandan government, for all of its achievements, is too tightly based on the personality and power of an individual, whereas in other countries, one of which is written about in great detail in my book, an example that I find particularly inspiring, again, Mali, which I mentioned a moment ago, where there is multi-party politics without cheating in elections, and with great availability by citizens to access to their politicians and a possibility to express preferences and transparency in the way state funds and resources are used. I think these kinds of examples are the most hopeful. Mali doesn't have quite the economic vibrance of Uganda, But I think in the long run, after Museveni is gone, what happens in Uganda is an open question, whereas Mali has already, and some of these other countries, which I would name, Senegal, Ghana, Benin, Botswana, just to name a few. Kenya is a new version of this kind of multi-party democracy. Nigeria is a multi-party democracy also, which has had more than one election, but which is tainted and rather more complicated than these other examples.
But to
these sorry.
I just wanted to say, but to the point that a little aid that reached the right people could make a big difference.
Yes, that, you know, we flatter ourselves when we think that we've tried hard to help Africa and it doesn't do any good. Just look at the mess whenever there's a big spike of crisis in one place or another. You know, we've done all we could to help these people and it just doesn't seem to do any good. Why bother? I've heard that expressed one way or another so many times before. The fact is that we do very little to help Africa economically. We spend less than 0.1% of our budget on aiding 1/6 of humanity. And Africa represents a very small portion even of our foreign assistance. So it's true that a little bit of money, a little bit more money spent wisely and a lot more political engagement with the continent could go a long way.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation about the hope and tragedy of Africa. To Edinburgh, Pennsylvania now, to Cecilia. Hi, Cecilia. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Now, I went to Kenya about over a decade ago on a study abroad, and I found it very rewarding, and it has given me an opportunity to tell others about Kenya and Africa. Such a small percentage go to those areas like Africa and places like that. How can we encourage and get more American students to go to those places as opposed to Europe, which culture is similar to ours?
I think that's a great question. I don't have an easy answer for you. I think a lot of it begins in education, that our schools should be doing a much better job in terms of educating people. And I'm talking about starting at least at the high school level, perhaps even at the junior high school level, where I think learning about Africa is really minimal and insufficient. Our schools have to begin doing a better job at that. We must remember also that a very sizable portion of the American population, we forget very easily in these more abstract discussions of Africa, traces its ancestry directly or indirectly to Africa. This is an extraordinarily important link, and a link that is sometimes not sufficiently taken advantage of. Africa suffers for the lack of advocacy, or the lack of sufficient advocacy by that population and by others who are simply never educated about Africa starting at a young age. University exchange programs are wonderful and should be multiplied. I think Africa, one of the great needs of the continent, is more education, and this is an area where volunteer work and exchange programs can really do wonders. I think there's also a reason for putting more pressure on our journalism, having better coverage of Africa and having more coverage of Africa so that it simply enters the conscience of people outside of these spikes of crisis when everything is made to seem hopeless and people are eventually throw up their hands and say, what's the use?
Hmm. Cecilia, thanks for the call. Certainly Africa has borne the imprint of some of its leaders. Charles Taylor of Liberia springs to mind. What's your most compelling memory of him?
I've had several run-ins with Charles Taylor, and a couple of them nearly fatal. I toured a presumed end, which didn't turn out to be an end, but what we thought of then as an end of the Liberian Civil War, which was a long-running, festering conflict that really ravaged this country, perhaps killed 200,000 or more people out of a population of just over 2 million. The country had been divided. There was a West African peacekeeping force keeping sort of control of keeping the rebels, Taylor's rebels, out of the capital, Monrovia. And Monrovia was swamped with refugees from the rest of the country. So the capital had most of the population lived in the capital, and the countryside had been largely emptied as a result of this devastating war. Taylor had his own capital in the north of the country, in the northeast of the country, sort of his own little rump country called, which he fancied as Greater Liberia. And right before a peace agreement had been reached in which he was going to come to the capital for the first time since the outbreak of the war and join a sort of government of national unity, I drove to Banga. I drove out of the capital, Monrovia, and through this devastated countryside to Taylor's rump capital. Had been promised by telephone an interview with Taylor if I could reach there, and he assured me that his fighters wouldn't kill me along the way. The peacekeeping troops, of course, thought I was crazy to try to go there. But we got to Banga, and I got to the presidential palace around 5 p.m. one evening, and Taylor's attendants told me that they would go find him and set things up, and we waited for a long time. The sun sets at around 6:15 in that part of Africa very regularly, and the sun began to set, and there's no sign of Taylor. We were extremely tired from having driven all day, and somebody finally came out and said, they'll put us up in your guest, in the presidential guest lodge. We had visions of a wonderful place, and because of his reputation for pompous ostentation. And a huge rainstorm ensued, and we were driven to this guest lodge. It turned out to be a place without electricity, a place without windows or running water that had been basically, it was a taken-over college building, a deserted college campus. And so in the morning we were supposed to see Taylor. We promised we would see him again, and or we would be given a chance to try to see him again, and we drove back to the palace where he sets up his residence and waited and waited and waited, and we finally had to give up the wait because we had to get back to the capital before he came back, and he was due back later in that day so that we could cover his arrival, which was an event of some significance. We got back to the capital after a harrowing drive. It was the appearance of trouble on the road because there had a huge number of roadblocks were thrown up, and Taylor's fighters were angry and suspicious, asking us what we had seen in Banga at each step of the way, as if there had been trouble there. We got to Monrovia, the capital, and we discovered that there had been an attack on the guest house where we had been put up just after we left. Rockets and grenades had been used to attack this guest house, and some of the other people staying in it, who had been generals and other senior officials in Taylor's movement, were the targets. The Taylor excuse for this was that they were plotting a coup against him, but Taylor was famous for killing opponents, and we very narrowly missed having been wiped out along with them. Later, there was a press conference with Taylor, and Taylor sat there very pompously before a group of timorous Liberian journalists saying that this was God's war and he was very happy to be back in Liberia, and I had to sort of cast off my my facade of Western independent sort of neutral journalism. And
I have to stop you there, I'm sorry, because we have to take a break. I do want to hear the second half of that story, but we're talking about the past and future of Africa this hour. Join us after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about hope and tragedy of Africa. Do we pay enough attention to Africa? What can and should America do to help Africa overcome its problems? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Howard French, senior writer at the New York Times. His new book is A Continent for the Taking, The Tragedy and Hope of Africa. And Howard, just before we took the break, you were about a third of the way into the story about this very dramatic press conference you covered with Charles Taylor in Liberia.
Yes, thank you. I was running up against the clock here. Taylor rushed back to the capital later that day. We found out that we had nearly missed attack at his guest lodge, and we were all summoned to a big press conference in which almost all the reporters present were Liberian journalists. And, you know, almost every Liberian has lost relatives in their war. It's a small country, and over 200,000 people, as I've said, died out of a population of 2 million. So everyone knows someone, and most people have relatives, several, that have died or have been hurt in this war. So Taylor gave a long set speech before the journalists, and then they opened up the questions. And in the speech he said that this had been God's war and that he was God's instrument and that it was a great tragedy that people had to die, but it was God's will and that God would take care of Liberia under his stewardship now. And then they opened the floor for questions, and no Liberian journalist dared ask him one. It was, I sort of imagined it as I watched it, sort of disbelieving, as the scene in The Wizard of Oz when they all get before the wizard. Here's this legendary wicked figure who has never made an appearance in the city before, suddenly before them. He's the motor of the war and a real personification of evil. And he's just described himself incredibly as God's agent and to people who lost family members. And I just couldn't retain my pose of the neutral Western journalist anymore. This is the only time it's ever happened to me in my career where what was being said in my presence was so outrageous that I just had to sort of rebel and openly revolt. And I got up and I told him it was outrageous, and that he should be ashamed of himself for feeding drugs to teenagers to turn them into soldiers, and for raping people and running roughshod over an entire nation just for his own personal ambition. And he was completely unprepared for this, and his assistant jumped up, and that was the end of the news conference.
I imagine your heart was beating pretty fast as you were saying that.
Yes, indeed. I was wondering what was the best way out of there as soon as I finished my statement.
I can imagine. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. To Cambridge, Massachusetts now. Hi, Eve. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I just spent close to a week in Botswana attending Civicus World Assembly, and I was so impressed with how respectful people are of each other, just in individual relationships, and how respectful of tradition. And I think we have a lot to learn from Africa, and we don't think of that. And I think everyone should read the number one ladies detective agency books by Alexander McCall Smith. They're a delight, and they're like a visit to Botswana.
Okay, thanks for the call, Eve. And I want to follow up on that point, Howard, because the tribal notion of a leader is someone who is responsible for his people, someone who looks out for them. So how do we account for the widespread corruption of, it seems, whoever comes to power in many of these countries?
Well, I must say that the colonial example for Africa was also wildly corrupt. The third biggest country in Africa, the single country that I deal with most in my book, is a country that was once called Zaire and is now again called Congo. And Congo was the personal possession, literally. It was not a state colony. It was the personal possession of King Leopold of Belgium, and he ruled it as such. It was his personal coffer and vault. And then after independence, after a brief flirtation with democratically choosing a man named Patrice Lumumba, the United States and Belgium helped overthrow him and installed a man named Mobutu, who then proceeded to rule in the fashion of Leopold. The French foreign minister once amusingly, colorfully called Mobutu, who had a very sharp personal dressing style, called him a walking bank vault with a cane and a leopard's skin cap, because that was the way Mobutu accoutred himself. This is not to say that African corruption is entirely the fault of European colonialism, but it is a very important precedent. And the way that we deal with Africa today, not bothering to insist on any firm accounting from Africa's leaders, buying its resources with our large companies, Shell, Chevron, Texaco, Exxon, all of the big oil majors buying resources from countries and doing very little to even request, never mind insist, that the revenues that we pay to these countries actually enter into the official books of government. These things help encourage and create the environment for the kinds of corruption that we see today. You also asked the question about tribal leaders having a responsibility. Well, you are indeed right. A major difference today is that very few African countries are constituted along tribal lines. These countries were confections thrown together hastily by Europeans with very little regard for the ethnic composition. And so when you get a leader of a country, the first thing that he tries to do, typically, classically, is take care of his own ethnic group and not to take care of the nation itself.
And yet, with all of the problems that you detail, the subtitle of your book, I have to come back to that, includes the word hope. So what reasons do you find for hope in Africa?
Well, I've mentioned a few, and I write a chapter on Mali, which I think is representative of what's happening in democracy in Africa more broadly. It's a story that doesn't get as much attention as it should because news, not just African news, but news tends to be bad news in our business. And so we know a lot more about the bad news than we do about the good news. Undeniably, there are great tragedies and awful things happening on a large scale in Africa. But, you know, Africa has great cultural resources. It has a tremendous history. Various parts of the continent have their own empires and kingdoms and, as I mentioned earlier, proto-states that they can, whose examples they can lean on as when they, as they come out of periods of turmoil to try to reestablish themselves and get a footing and enter the 21st century. There are also very important things that we can do. There's no constituency for spending a lot of money budgetarily in Africa. Jesse Helms famously called aiding Africa financially throwing money down a rat hole. But we can lift subsidies on very marginal agricultural products in this country. I'm thinking about cotton. I'm thinking about sugar. I'm thinking about certain sorts of tropical fruits and oils and on textiles. And this would affect a very small number of Americans, cost very modest amounts of money, not lay out any money toward Africa, but allow hundreds of millions of Africans a sort of a purchase on the international economic ladder, a way up. We're not doing that, and we're depriving them of a fair chance. We can also insist on corporate governance, in which we sit down with Western Europe, we sit down with the Japanese and the Chinese, and we say what's happening in Africa is a shame and a blight on humanity, that it's indecent, and we have to proceed in a fair and conscientious manner with this continent to prevent any further disaster there. This involves insisting that when we buy large quantities of oil or any other particular mineral resource, that there are certain parameters that we jointly enforce, that the monies go into state coffers, that they appear on the books, and that they're spent relatively wisely. We can't govern these countries, but we can insist on that, and we can also prevent or insist that they not spend money or they spend within a certain minimum respect a certain maximum of their money on defense expenditures.
Howard French, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Howard's new book is A Continent for the Taking, The Tragedy and Hope of Africa. And you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, reflections of a father whose son spent most of the past year stationed in Afghanistan. This is On Point. The Pentagon is drawing up plans to send fresh troops to Iraq in case generals there request more soldiers to deal with the recent upturn in violence. Earlier this month, defense officials announced a 90-day extension for 20,000 troops who were scheduled to be on their way home from Iraq. Massachusetts resident Frank Schaefer understands the pain and unease of parents who are awaiting the return of their military sons and daughters from a war zone. His son, Marine Corporal John Schaefer, was deployed in Afghanistan for 11 months beginning last March. Corporal Schaefer was on the front lines of the hunt for al-Qaeda holdouts. Frank Schaefer kept a detailed journal during the months his son was away, which he has turned into the new book, Faith of Our Sons, A Father's Wartime Diary. In this radio diary, Frank Schaefer recalls the hardest part of having his son deployed in the line of fire on the other side of the world.
The hardest part of having my son deployed overseas in a war zone came in what you might consider to be small ways. I'll give you an example. I was out raking some leaves, and I heard a crunch on the gravel of my driveway behind the house, and my heart just constricted because I said, "Who's that? The postman's already come. Is it the van bringing the Marines to tell me my son's died?" A wrong number in the middle of the night. It wasn't a wrong number anymore. It might have been John calling, and I was up, and my heart was beating, and it's 4 a.m. Well, I'm not getting back to sleep again. Did I miss his call? You know, was someone trying to reach me to tell me he's been injured? It was basically life lived on the edge of extinction in a way that I never understood before. I felt like I'd had a layer of my skin peeled back and that everything was raw. And the least breeze would almost knock me down because the level of worry and fear for your child is such that the first words in a news bulletin that says, today an American was killed. Well, before it was somebody else might have been killed. Now it's my kid every time. I remember him calling once and casually saying, oh, by the way, in my last email, did I mention to you I was just shot at by a 12-year-old? And I said no with my heart in my mouth. Terrible things happened out there. One of the things I found that was so difficult for me was not only what might happen to John physically, but also just morally and spiritually. You know, what's it mean when your 22-year-old kid, who was such a gentle guy that when we would go fishing on the Merrimack River, he would always implore me to let the stripers we caught go, even if they were of the size you can keep. You know, 5 years later, John is picking up the bodies of some dead children who were killed by the Taliban. These kids were killed and their teacher was killed because they were teaching little girls, you know, and John had been handing them candy and this kind of thing and helping them and with their school books and the rest. And so, you know, the thing that just tears your heart out is not only the danger your child's in, but what they are seeing and what they're going through. For me, the biggest change was just realizing I'm totally powerless here. You know, when my older son went to Georgetown University or my older daughter Jessica went to New York University, you know, if they needed something, you could send money, you could do this, you could do that, you could visit. But now, you know, with John, when he was out on the front in Afghanistan, he was completely beyond my capability to help him. Basically, I was left, you know, in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, praying for him. And I would find my wife, Jeannie, curled up on his bed, asleep in the morning, having wandered restlessly through the night. And that 11 months seemed like 11 years, literally. You know, as I think of the parents now whose kids are in Iraq or Afghanistan or overseas who are in this war, my heart just sort of crumples and constricts when I think of them because I know what they're going through, and it's really a kind of a living hell. The trivial aspects of our culture, whether it's the celebrities on women's magazines all the way to, my own ambitions as a novelist, seem pretty pitiful and small compared to the sacrifice our young women and men make and their families make, and it's given me a completely new sense of proportion in the face of that that I had never understood before. John got home safely after 2 deployments, but I'll tell you what, when I see the news now and I hear, you know, some guy got killed in Fallujah yesterday, you know, that could be my kid. I actually cry tears for that guy because I know what that mother's going through. At least I know the first part, and I never used to, gotta admit it. So I peel a layer back, and I feel attached to my country now, but it's in a kind of a new way of identifying with people that I never knew I had in me before. It just came because, you know, having them out there, all of a sudden, these are my kids. I got 100, and I mean, this may sound awfully sentimental and stupid, but I got 130,000 children right now getting shot at in Iraq, and I got 9,000 children getting shot at in Afghanistan. And, you know, I'm not going to sleep well till they're all home again.
Frank Schaefer is the author of the new book, Faith of Our Sons, A Father's Wartime Diary. He lives in Salisbury, Massachusetts. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.